food. Looking back offers the opportunity to rewrite our own stories in more constructive and positive ways. Jean-Pierre took a story of poverty and turned it into a story of abundance. I took a story of anger and turned it into a story of discovery. In both cases, a hurtful past is redeemed through a new perspective. Can you remember an event that was painful at the time, but that now makes you feel grateful? I suspect most of us can. When we think back, a contrast emerges between the immediate loss and eventual blessing. This creates a new vision of our own personal history, and this contrast is fertile ground for gratefulness. Remembering the actual past, even if that past was difficult and filled with ingratitude, allows us to see the past from an angle impossible at the time and paves the way for fuller appreciation of present joys. Present, or wide sight. A few years ago, I was being interviewed about a book I had recently written. The interviewer, a deeply spiritual woman, commented, "You have soft eyes. This entire book is an exercise in soft eyes." I felt a little panicked because I did not know what she meant. Seeing my distress, she continued, "The capacity to see widely, to view the whole picture." I nodded. We went on. As soon as I got back to my hotel room, I did an internet search of soft eyes. Sometimes called wide-angle seeing, the term comes from the martial arts and refers to awareness that reaches toward the periphery, the edge of what we usually see. The Quaker spiritual writer Parker Palmer describes it this way. In the Japanese art of Aikido, there is a practice called soft eyes. It means to widen one's periphery to take in more of the world. If a stimulus is introduced to an unprepared person, his eyes narrow and the flight-fight response takes over. If the same unexpected stimulus comes to someone with soft eyes, the natural reflex is transcended and a more authentic response takes its place, such as thinking a new thought. Soft eyes, it seems to me, is an evocative image for what happens when we gaze on sacred reality. Now our eyes are open and receptive, able to take in the greatness of the world and the grace of great things. Taking in the grace of great things may well be an alternate definition of gratitude. Seeing with soft eyes alerts us to gratefulness in our present lives. Sometimes gratitude hides at the edges of our experience, like when I was fired. Although I eventually learned gratitude through hindsight, I was also nurturing a capacity for soft eyes at the time, and that was helping me see gratitude even then. Although it was initially difficult to apprehend, many good things happened as that position ended. I had begun writing for the local newspaper. The university across town invited me to teach part-time, and I made many new friends. People went out of their way to be kind to me, opened new professional doors, and listened when I was near despair. Despite losing a job, I had just enough money to get by. I joined a wonderful new church, and I met the man who would become my life partner. I stopped focusing on immediate worries and learn to look toward the edges of life's surprises. The gratitude journal reminded me to look toward the periphery of blessings. I had to look beyond challenges to find the larger grace of great things that sometimes seems to hide just out of view. I was learning a new perspective, orienting my life toward new horizons, and discovering that gratitude could guide me as I moved ahead. The widely quoted wisdom of poet Maya Angelou became real. If you must look back, do so forgivingly. If you must look forward, do so prayerfully. However, the wisest thing you can do is be present in the present, gratefully. Seeing with soft eyes opens a wider vision of present circumstances, lessens fear and anxiety, and alerts us to new possibilities for our lives. Future or foresight. When we reflect on gratitude and time, it is not hard to see how we can be thankful for what has happened in the past and what is occurring in our lives now. But the future? How does gratitude relate to that? David DeStenno, a professor at Northeastern University, makes this case. When life's got you down, gratitude can seem like a chore. Sure, you'll go through the motions and say the right things, but you might not truly feel grateful in your heart. It can be like saying, "I'm happy for you," to someone who just got the job you wanted. The words and feelings often don't match. This disconnect is unfortunate, though. It comes from a somewhat misguided view that gratitude is all about looking backward, back to what has already been. But in reality, that's not how gratitude truly works. At a psychological level, gratitude isn't about passive reflection. It's about building resilience. It's not about being thankful for things that have already occurred and thus can't be changed. It's about ensuring the benefits of what comes next. It's about making sure that tomorrow and the day after, you will have something to be grateful for. When psychologists speak of resilience, they are referring to our capacity to grow into our best selves, to be healthy, creative, emotionally balanced, and mature people. Positive emotions like gratitude foster resiliency, which strengthens our physical health, especially our heart health, and the ability to recover more quickly from illness and surgery. Thus, gratitude can actually create better outcomes in our future health. Resiliency also works to improve psychological health. According to one study, resilient individuals reported fewer symptoms of depression and trauma following the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Having a grateful disposition in advance of that national crisis gave some Americans better coping skills and helped them navigate those frightening and difficult days with fewer negative effects than their fellow citizens. Researchers discovered that positive emotions not only make people feel good in the present, but they also increase the likelihood that people will function well and feel good in the future and cause an upward spiral of well-being. Gratitude now anticipates increased positive emotions in the future. But gratitude now and in the future also arises from practice. When I had lost my job and I did not generally feel grateful, I joined a new church. At a moment of deep despair and isolation, I heard that a minister at Trinity Episcopal Church in Santa Barbara, a church I did not attend, had mounted a campaign among mainline Protestant clergy in town to try to pressure the college to keep me on. Their effort failed. But I could not believe that a pastor whom I had never met would see the injustice of my situation and try to do something about it. I still remember how completely surprised and utterly humbled I felt upon learning about his effort. I made an appointment to meet him, to thank him for what he had done. We became friends. As a result of his action and the gratitude I experienced in response, I joined the church he served. Although we were not really thinking about it, we had enacted gratitude. He did something for my benefit, and I responded by both saying thank you and becoming a member of the congregation. We bonded through gift and gratitude. That bond, with its resulting participation in Trinity Church, in turn created more bonds. The people in that community were some of the most giving human beings I have ever known, and the church existed as a continually expanding circle of gifts and appreciation in which individuals were sometimes benefactors and oftentimes beneficiaries. We were all givers and receivers. I had no way of knowing in advance, but the friendships forged around the practice of gratitude at Trinity formed the basis of my future life, everything from becoming a writer to getting married again and having a child. Life in that church consisted of mutual support and mutual gifts, and because of that mutuality, we developed healthy obligations to each other and deepened our capacity to trust. This was not a quid pro quo exchange in which we earned credit from one another for good works. It was instead a dynamic structure of relationships that ensured the existence of a community of care stretching into the future. More than a positive emotion, this sort of gratitude became the foundation of my healing and deepened my ability to take risks and make good choices for the next decade of my life. It went well beyond the immediate event of saying thank you. Practice takes time. A well-known rule of practice says that to become an expert at something, you need to devote 10,000 hours to doing it. Gratitude is not a practice that can be counted in hours. Instead, it invites us to engage the longer arc of time. In order for it to become a habit, it asks that we attend to seeing time more fully, engaging the past more graciously, living more appreciatively now, and building thanks into the foundation of our future. Attending to our lives with hindsight, widesight, and foresight moves gratefulness from emotion to ethic. Thus, gratitude may feel good, and those good feelings do good things for us. But as an ethical disposition, gratitude is a strong basis for creating a good life. The habit of gratefulness helps us thrive. It not only takes time, but it can change the way we experience the times of our lives. Chapter 4. Intentional Practice. Like other forms of practice, gratefulness makes us more resilient and flexible, and also offers a way to frame and learn from everything that unfolds in our lives. Christy Nelson. On September 22, 2015, Phyllis Tickle, one of the wisest spiritual writers in recent decades, died at age 81. Phyllis was many things: a devotional writer, a poet, a playwright, a journalist, and a professor. And indeed, she was a friend. She did not die quickly. Diagnosed with cancer at the beginning of 2015, she spent those last months writing colleagues. My email is full of exchanges from that time. At first, our notes were gossipy and hopeful, but they turned more serious as the weeks unfolded. Toward the end, they consisted mostly of my sending her poetry and short letters of gratitude, and her increasingly brief replies. About 5 weeks before she passed away, her final substantial note to me read, "Thanks, dear heart, for the prayers. Things wind down here slowly but surely, and I am mightily content that it should be so. It is good to have this time between the knowing and the actual ending. Obviously, we all know it, but to have so specific and well-defined a time frame is a benison, and I am grateful." She faced death as she had learned to live life, thankfully. What remarkable calm, I thought as I read her note. I also knew I would not sound quite so thankful. I suspected that I would be raging against death. Having lived 8 decades, however, Phyllis understood gratitude in the story of the past, present, and future. I have rarely known anyone who said thank you and meant it as deeply as she. The equanimity with which Phyllis embraced her earthly end was shaped by lifelong habits of gratefulness. Of all her practices of gratitude, the most important was her commitment to praying 4 times each day, a set of traditional Christian prayers of praise and thanksgiving. Phyllis knew that the long story of our lives is made up of precious hours and days, and paying attention to the daily cycle of time is keenly important in shaping a life of gratitude. She wrote a series of books on the subject, a set of prayer guides thick with praise and thanksgivings. Our days are so steeped in routine and habits that most are invisible to us. However, we tend to organize and attend to daily time in patterns generally related to work. Most people wake up with the sun, go to work in fields, homes, or offices, break at midday, finish work, and end the day with a meal and rest. This everyday round is sometimes marked by religious observance, punctuated by prayers, bells, and calls to devotion. For more than 1,000 years in Christian societies, the hours of work were interwoven with hours of prayer, forming a cycle of morning, noon, and evening rituals practiced by laity, monks, nuns, and priests. The same is true for Muslims, Jews, and Buddhists. The hallowing of the hours in a day is fundamental to a faithful life, and remembering blessings and giving thanks is a shared practice across world religions. Phyllis knew the connection between work and thanks. On more than one occasion, I watched her leave a meeting or conference room to go and pray. She would step out briefly, open a book, utter a few ancient words, and come back into the group, often picking up exactly where she had left off. As a mentor, she taught many things. None, however, struck so close to the heart as her natural habit of giving thanks in prayer. Minding the day. The practice of hourly thanksgiving has faded in modern society, where secularism and pluralism generally inhibit public rituals of thanksgiving. You still see it in places like Assisi or Mecca or Kathmandu, where bells and minarets and gongs still call the populace to prayer. But for the most part, public prayers have given way to private ones, often in simplified forms. In some Christian churches, such a practice is known as daily devotions. I grew up Methodist, and despite the fact that John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, was famous for his regular practice of daily prayer, such piety was largely lost to us. I first encountered daily devotions long before my friendship with Phyllis. Instead, I discovered the practice of daily prayer when I was a teenager at an evangelical church. I will never forget my friend Phil, who woke up before dawn and spent an hour in prayer. His Bible was worn from use, and I suspect his knees were too. At 16, he seemed holy. The entire business of daily devotions flummoxed me, though. I asked Phil what he did for an hour. He replied that he read the Bible, took notes, marked the bits of scripture that spoke to him, memorized verses, offered thanks for the day, and then prayed for his needs and the needs of others. I made a valiant effort to imitate his piety, but I failed. I did, however, mess up several Bibles with yellow highlighters. I never could understand prayer. The whole business seemed like some sort of magic trick. Praying for God to pay attention to a crisis and fix it? Intercessory prayer of this nature made me wonder if God was not a divine vending machine. Put in the right change and get out what you wanted. A spiritual quid pro quo? The exercise puzzled me. As a result, I began collecting prayer books. If I could not pray well on my own, I figured I could learn. When I first started reading prayer books, I noticed that most had personal supplications that were topically arranged for illness, healing, children, grief, job loss, financial struggle, and so on. When I joined an Episcopal church, I discovered a small section, a mere 7 pages long, in the Book of Common Prayer called Daily Devotions for Individuals and Families. Of all the pages in that complicated prayer book, they came to mean the most to me. Those brief pages were the remnant of the ancient Christian tradition of praying the Liturgy of the Hours, also called the Divine Office or Daily Office, at morning, noon, early evening, and night. For most of my early 20s, praying through those short liturgies became a lifeline. I especially loved the morning words. Open my lips, O Lord, and my mouth shall proclaim your praise. The brief bits of scripture interspersed with traditional Anglican written prayers framed my days. What I appreciated most were its brief readings. Texts not dependent on me for complex study. The days could be marked not by heroic spiritual exertion, but by simple moving phrases of blessing, scripture, prayer, and assurance. And always thanks. Those devotions alerted me to the ancient practice of the hours. About a decade later, Phyllis and I became friends. One of her great projects was a 3-volume prayer manual for the daily office, and those devotionals now sit on my shelf. Next to her books is a wide array of contemporary versions of the hours and daily prayer, evidence that the practice has been undergoing a renaissance in the last 2 decades. I do not pray any of them as I should, but I have learned something quite simple from all of them. The ancient practice did not involve an hour-long Bible study with a highlighter, nor did it focus on getting something from God. Almost every rite of prayer at every hour of the day in each of those books begins in a similar way, with a form of thanks. O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. Psalm 95:1-2. The daily hours do not focus on what we want or need. The hours start with gratitude. Ancient Christian wisdom is that the first words of each day should be those of thanks. Of course, Christian prayers direct praise and gratefulness to God, who is understood to be the giver of all gifts. The same is true for Jewish prayers. My friend David Gregory, journalist and author, who is quite serious in his Jewish faith, opens his day with these words, I offer thanks to you, living and eternal King, for you have mercifully restored my soul within me. Your faithfulness is great. Muslims and other theists have similar practices, but one need not believe in God to give thanks. It is just as possible to begin a day by directing thanks toward the rhythm of nature, whereby the sun rises or the body awakens, to farmers who grew the food for our breakfast, or to workers in a foreign land who made the clothes we put on our backs. Open my lips. May thanks come forth. The point is to start each day remembering that life is a gift and that we are interdependent with sacred presence, natural forces, and human relationships even as we wake. In a very real way, morning gratitude is a primary form of mindfulness, a practice of paying attention to abundance and life. In order to mind the day, I keep a single page of gratitude prayers by my bed, and I read one each morning. This is a recent page with gratefulness meditations from a naturalist, a Buddhist monk, a poet, and two Christian writers. Awakening. In a moment of peace, I give thanks to the source of all peace. As I set forth into the day, the birds sing with new voices, and I listen with new ears and give thanks. Harriet Kofalk. Waking up this morning, I see the blue sky. I join my hands in thanks for the many wonders of life, for having 24 brand new hours. The sun is rising on the forest, and so is my awareness. Thich Nhat Hanh. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees, and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. E. E. Cummings. For the freshness of this new day, thanks be to you, O God, for morning's gift of clarity, its light like the first day's dawn, thanks be to you. In this newborn light, let us see afresh. In this gateway onto what has never been before, let our soul breathe hope for the earth, for the creatures, for the human family. Let our soul breathe hope. John Philip Newell. With a morning bird song, my heart echoes thank you. With the rustling sounds in the kitchen, my heart echoes thank you. With the early noise of the suburbs, my heart echoes thank you. With the awakening words of day, I add my voice and say thank you. I wrote the last one. My family laughs about it because I frequently complain of being shaken from sleep by either a noisy lawn service or my neighbor's motorcycle. But, as I pointed out, that was what I most needed, to be able to say thank you first thing in the morning, a leaf blower or obnoxious machine notwithstanding. Gratitude sets the intention for the day, reminding us to notice blessings and gifts as we move through the hours ahead. I have come to think of hourly prayer as punctuating time with gratitude. Meals, especially lunch and dinner, are good times to say thank you. Noon provides a check on the day, a moment to reaffirm an intention toward gratefulness. In my family, even at the hardest spiritual times, we have always said grace at dinner. This old-fashioned practice of saying thank you over our evening meal has grounded us for two decades. Believe me, it is not always lyrical or deep. But it is a moment to remind us that we are receivers of the gifts of food and health, to appreciate joys and successes, and to be open for what we and others need. Apparently, we are not alone in this practice. According to a recent poll, nearly half of all Americans say grace before meals at least a few times a week, either as a ritual prayer or a spontaneous one. If morning marks the intention to live the day gratefully, night is the time to review, reflect, and offer thanksgiving. Many spiritual guides recommend writing a few things you were grateful for in a journal shortly before going to sleep, times during the day when you felt moments of abundance and joy. The Jesuits, the Roman Catholic monastic order of which Pope Francis is a member, recommend a prayerful evening review of the day, a practice they call the examen, Latin for examination. It involves five simple steps and centers on gratefulness. 1. Become aware of God's presence. 2. Review the day with gratitude. 3. Pay attention to your emotions. 4. Choose one feature of the day and pray from it. 5. Look toward tomorrow. This need not be a long or involved process. Instead, its simple format serves to mark the day's end in a way that draws the mind and heart toward grace and gifts. Notice that the examen asks you to review with gratitude and then consider your emotions. This is not a random reflection on your feelings. Instead, it focuses on emotions after you recall blessings. There is a spiritual flow in these steps: awareness, gratitude, affirmations, prayer, and hope. The examen intentionally orders thoughts, closing the day with thanksgiving, and setting positive expectations for tomorrow. Of course, one need not be a Jesuit or even a Christian to find the five steps of the examen meaningful. They are one way to recount gratitude in a day. Writing in a journal, remembering the good things of the day, making a list of the people who were kind or helpful to you, counting beads of blessing on a bracelet or rosary, and thinking about pleasant experiences offer the same opportunity for thankfulness. On Twitter, Parker Molloy, a widely followed journalist and LGBTQ activist, maintains a nightly thankfulness thread to which she posts one daily thing for which she is grateful, ranging from her dog or the weather to sharing a good dinner with her partner. It is the last thing she does on social media to end the day. You can sense how, after the rough and tumble of controversial political comment, giving thanks grounds her spirituality. Not only is this a beneficial spiritual practice, several scientific studies have shown that people who practice gratitude right before bedtime sleep better, more soundly, and more deeply. An evening ritual of thanksgiving allows you to end the day with less stress and a greater capacity to rest. The Buddha offered these words to sum up the day: "Let us rise up and be thankful, for if we didn't learn a lot today, at least we learned a little. And if we didn't learn a little, at least we didn't get sick. And if we got sick, at least we didn't die. So let us all be thankful." Or, as one psychologist suggests for reviewing the day, count blessings, not sheep. More than 40 years ago, when I asked my friend Phil about his morning devotions, I never imagined that it was the first step to discovering that the hours of each day can be marked with gratitude. Not only should we give thanks in all things, we can give thanks at all times. With practice and with ever-widening awareness, we see that gratitude frames our days, this day, this hour, right now. Blessings. Years ago, I had a friend, I will call her Elizabeth, who was kind, generous, smart, and appreciated by others for her open-handedness. I liked her for these qualities. She was, however, at the same time, a surprisingly negative person. Elizabeth had grown up in a wealthy family who lived in a posh suburb, attended a private school, and had traveled the world widely. She was cultured and seemed to have everything: beautiful clothes, expensive furniture, new cars, and a first-rate education. In the future, she stood to inherit a fortune. I was in awe of her. She possessed every advantage in life, having things I could barely dream existed. It amazed me that she would even want to be my friend. I mentioned my admiration, if not my envy, to a mutual acquaintance. She replied, "Perhaps you shouldn't feel that way. You know, Elizabeth's had a really hard life." "What?" I responded. "She's had to fight for so many things," she continued, and then she listed a long litany of difficulties Elizabeth had experienced. That conversation made me notice what had escaped my notice before. My friend, who had so much, often spoke of what she did not have and the burdens she carried. No one's life is perfect, of course, but she portrayed herself as uniquely challenged, plagued by misunderstandings and hardship. She rarely spoke of her multitude of gifts as blessings. Instead, she minimized good things and went out of her way not to mention them. Whenever I spoke of some financial or personal struggle I was having, she replied by reciting the obstacles she had faced. After a while, it felt like a competition to see who had the worst life circumstances to overcome. Although our friendship lasted for years, it was never very stable. I always wanted to shout, "Please, just appreciate the many advantages you have in life." But I never did. The whole thing dissolved into mutual resentment. There was no talk of blessings. Our friendship broke apart in that competition for life's toughest path. Instead of one-upping each other with blessings, we one-downed each other with failures. In the end, we could not even be grateful for one another. One of the most interesting studies related to gratitude explores the difficulties and advantages in our lives as headwinds and tailwinds. Headwinds are the resistance one encounters in a race when the wind is literally in one's face. Tailwinds are the opposite, the wind at one's back. Researchers Shai Davidi and Thomas Gilovich discover that people tend to pay more attention to life's headwinds because they are harder to overcome. We ignore tailwinds because we adjust to the advantages they give us. Tailwind benefits tend to be invisible, but headwinds, we boast of fighting them. We remember difficult challenges more vividly than what comes easily to us. Because we pay more attention to what is hard, what we feel we have worked for, we tend to believe that our own life has been full of barriers and challenges, more severe than those experienced by others. This belief, in turn, causes envy. How? As the researchers note, when people falsely believe that their road has been especially difficult, they can easily become resentful of those they falsely believe have had an easier path, resulting in feelings of thwarted entitlement. The flip side of this toxic stew of resentment, envy, and entitlement, claim Davidi and Gilovich, is gratitude. When we overvalue the struggle and challenge of headwinds, we miss the opportunity to be grateful for the gifts, the tailwinds, that assist us. An understanding of how easy it is for people to get in touch with their headwinds, suggest the authors, and how hard it is to fully appreciate their tailwinds, can help explain why a consistent connection to gratitude can be so elusive. Sometimes we might speak of nice things as blessings, a kind of pious way of talking about material comfort or personal privilege. But what if blessings are, at least in part, the tailwinds of our lives? The invisible benefits that are conferred on us, everything from political policies to economic advantages to social relationships, and that we receive unnoticed, are indeed blessings. In this framework, blessings emerge as the contributions others have made to our lives, either as personal gifts or gifts of a larger community, things such as a good public school paid for by tax money. Blessings are not pious rewards for good behavior. Blessings are the boost bestowed on us by systems, structures, families, and other benefactors who assist us on our way. Headwinds, barriers. Tailwinds, blessings. Headwinds make us say, "I earned this." Tailwinds should not be invisible. Instead, they should call forth, "I received this. I am so grateful." This helps explain what happened with Elizabeth. "Her headwinds of difficulty were invisible to me, but her tailwinds of privilege were not. It was just the opposite for her. The burdens she found painful she magnified, but the boosts of wealth she paid no attention to. To be honest, my headwinds always had to do with money, and my tailwinds, things I generally ignored, were things she admired. When the friendship ended, I reflected on what had happened. Instead of focusing on her failure to see her blessings and my resulting envy of her blessings, I began to consider my own blessings, those things she might have seen that eluded me, like intellectual curiosity and social ease. Schoolwork and friendships were my tailwinds. I loved to read, learn, and write. I was an extrovert and loved people and parties, but I rarely paid attention to these things. They were simply the gifts of my life. However, I always worried about paying tuition, supporting myself, having a functioning car. I remember the difficulty of working four jobs in graduate school just to stay afloat and trying to survive after losing that first job. There were headwinds aplenty. As a result of failing at my friendship with Elizabeth, however, I took stock. I assessed my own life more realistically. I realized that getting good grades and being well-liked were not irrelevant to the person I had become. They were blessings, boosts given to me through DNA, growing up in a decent suburb in post-war America, having caring teachers and mentors, and my mother's endless cheerleading. The headwinds can still command my attention, but tailwinds are more obvious to me now than ever. I continue to understand the privileges that have boosted me, appreciate what was good about them, and work to make sure others experience more tailwinds than headwinds. The tailwinds are gifts, and being aware of them makes me more grateful and, I hope, generous. Choosing gratitude as a way of life. A friend of mine recently went through a painful personal crisis. At first, it seemed to be the result of a breakup. Then it went deeper, as he realized that he did not understand the meaning or purpose of his own life. He was both anxious and depressed. "I think," he confessed, "that I'm really having a spiritual crisis." After many long talks about faith, I finally gave him a small book of gratitude quotes. I suggested that he might take his focus off feelings of loss and instead try to find something good each day. I hoped he might see how much there was to be thankful for, that despite immediate challenges, he was a gifted person with much to offer the world. Maybe looking for gratitude could help him find his way. A couple of days later, he texted me a quote from the book that had spoken to him. "God, help me to quiet my noisy, worrisome mind in my ordinary world. Help me to relax in the familiar and to be aware of and appreciate it." Of all the possible quotes in the book for him to choose, this one surprised me. I had expected something more straightforward, perhaps comforting words about gifts in abundance. But his quote was a prayer. "God, help me." With what? "To relax in the familiar and to be aware of and appreciate it." My friend was not asking for a dramatic healing, for answers to be written in the sky, or for God to fix his problems. He wanted to see the world around him more fully and deeply, to develop greater awareness, and to be grateful for what was already there. When I read his text, I thought, well, isn't that what we all need to do? That is what a practice of gratitude comes to. All around us, every day, there are gifts. Whether we are facing a crisis or not, no matter our challenges or feelings, there are gifts, most of which go unnoticed, unappreciated, and often disregarded. Sometimes they take us by surprise. We experience the aha of being helped or suddenly seeing a beautiful sunset, and the emotion of gratitude wells up in our being. Gifts seem to spring upon us like an epiphany, bursting our hearts with that wild admixture of humility and joy that we know is gratitude. But if we cultivate our awareness to see those gifts more often, with clearer and more consistent vision, something else happens. Thankfulness becomes more habitual, a regular part of how we respond to the world. Yes, gratitude still holds the power to surprise and to elicit a strong emotional response. However, as a habit, it also becomes a steadying companion, incorporated into the story of our lives. Gratitude is not just a knock-your-socks-off revelation of goodness and beauty. It emerges as a daily, even hourly, disposition of appreciation toward familiar gifts, including the tailwinds of blessing. This kind of paying attention is often referred to as mindfulness. I like that word, and that more people are embracing practices of mindfulness. But I think mindfulness involves choosing, too. We can choose to believe that we are autonomous beings in complete command of our own lives, reliant upon no one and nothing but ourselves. We can choose to focus on our failures or our losses, on what we feel entitled to or what we deserve. We can choose anger, fear, resentment, grief, hubris, or pain. We can choose to live our lives stuck in our worst moments. We can choose to believe that everyone and everything are against us. We can choose to define ourselves on the basis of someone else's violence, prejudice, or injustice toward us. We can choose to define life as a zero-sum game. We can choose every negative philosophy, theology, or ideology that cuts us off from grace. And we can choose to think that there is no one and nothing to thank. Even if we make good choices, it can be hard to follow through. The failed diet, the broken New Year's resolution, the long-distance friendship that gets neglected, the gratitude practice that falls by the wayside. It often seems that the more steel will we apply to a desire to change, the more miserable the failure. We all know this. Even those we consider saints knew it as well. In the New Testament book of Romans, St. Paul cries out in frustration, "I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate." In that passage, Paul is making a rather complicated and distinctly Christian argument about human behavior and sin. But Paul solves his dilemma in a way that goes beyond a Christian response and is widely applicable to practicing gratitude in any tradition. "For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the flesh," he proclaims. "But those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on things of the Spirit." Or, as Jesus put it, "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Both Paul and Jesus are speaking of our inclinations. Do our desires incline toward what we think we have earned or deserve, the flesh? Or are they drawn toward a life of appreciation and grace, the Spirit? Where is your treasure? Your heart? Which direction do you choose? What draws your soul? If you choose ingratitude, I cannot help you. But most of us do not willingly say, "I have decided to live my life free from thanksgiving." Even at ungrateful moments, we feel the tug towards something else. But it can be hard to get there. Ingratitude often results from misunderstanding the nature of thanks, failing to see the larger picture of our lives, or forgetting to nurture a spirit of gratefulness. We ignore the tailwinds. Instead, we fixate on what has hindered us, and that mutates into envy and entitlement. When we neglect gratitude, we are, in effect, making a choice toward negative emotions, which in turn foster more negativity. But when, if even for a little while, we choose gratefulness, that choice builds on itself and begins to create a spiral of appreciation. The first choice, even if only a vague inclination, sets up the next choice, and the next one beyond that. Thus, when we do the very thing we hate, it is often because we have helped to create an environment of the flesh in our lives. We have made a habit of things we do not want to do. They are reflexive. We do not intentionally choose ingratitude. We choose it because we have made a habit of it, and we are not even always aware of the negative habit we have constructed. The real power of habit, claims Charles Duhigg, is the insight that your habits are what you choose them to be. To choose gratitude is not an act of dogged determination. To choose gratitude is to hear an inner urging toward thanks, to be aware of the grace in life, and to respond. This urging comes from what Paul calls spirit and Jesus calls heart. And, for whatever reason, we turn. That single turn is a choice. It is not as much will as it is a reply to an invitation for a deeper, better life. We may start gratitude practices like writing a journal or listing daily blessings, succeed for a time, and then forget and fail. But, and this is the important part, even if a specific technique fails, it has helped to create a larger environment of gratefulness. Interventions may be short-term, techniques difficult to maintain, practices hard to master. But these actions will have shaped a spiritual habitat in which new habits can form. In that environment, it becomes easier to choose gratitude the next time, with fewer struggles and less guilt, and eventually thanksgiving becomes habitual. Thus habits seed a spiritual habitat in which we can dwell in greater awareness of gratitude, so that gratitude enters in and inhabits us. We can intentionally practice gratitude through greater awareness, through specific techniques, by developing new routines, and by strengthening habits of gratitude. And if we do these things, gratefulness becomes part of who we are. English essayist Samuel Johnson once said, "Gratitude is a fruit of great cultivation." The Christian scriptures liken gratitude to joy, a fruit of the Spirit. Gratitude is not only an emotion, it is something we do. But it is not a program. It is like tending a garden. It takes planting and watering and weeding. It takes time and attention. It takes learning. It takes routine. But eventually, the ground yields, shoots come forth, and thanksgiving blooms. Part 3. We, emotions. Joy and celebration. Praise song for struggle. Praise song for the day. Praise song for every hand-lettered sign, the figuring it out at kitchen tables. Some live by love thy neighbor as thyself. Others by first do no harm, or take no more than you need. What if the mightiest word is love? Elizabeth Alexander. Chapter 5. grateful together. Gratitude is happiness doubled by wonder. G.K. Chesterton. We arrived fairly early, but it was already uncomfortably hot, and there was stiff competition for parking places. We faced a long walk to the venue and the possibility of getting stuck in the nosebleed seats. We wanted to beat the crowds, but when we pulled into the parking lot, we knew we had failed. Dozens and dozens of ebullient teenagers carrying identical blue academic regalia were headed toward the arena. Trailing behind them were parents, siblings, grandparents, and friends, holding congratulatory signs, blue and white balloons, and bouquets of roses. My daughter shook with anxiety and excitement. After 4 years of hard work, she had finished with honors and was headed to college in the fall. This was an end, and this was a new beginning. As we got out of the car, she glanced at the legions of her classmates and then turned a nervous smile in my direction. I patted her on the back and gave her a little hug. We gathered up her robe and stole. We joined the advancing throng, all there to celebrate high school graduation. The day ahead would be long with speeches, awards, and 600 students called forward to receive diplomas. Our local high school, West Potomac High School, is a huge public school with a diverse student body. 40% of the students are white, 30% Hispanic, 20% Black, and the rest Asian, Native American, and biracial. Even though it is part of the well-regarded Fairfax County school system in Virginia, West Potomac's student body is not particularly wealthy. Government statistics say that 38% of the students are economically disadvantaged, and a large number are either immigrants or first-generation Americans, just like our neighborhood. We found some seats not unreasonably far from the action, and I searched the stands for familiar faces. I did not immediately see anyone I knew. We had never been at a school-wide event before. Most of the things we had attended at her school involved the honor students and the crew team, and I could not help but notice the incredible diversity of the crowd. I had not been to a high school graduation since my own, more than 30 years ago, from Saguaro High School in Scottsdale, Arizona. Scottsdale was, and still is, a very white and very rich place. I think my high school class included one biracial family, a few recent immigrants from Middle Eastern countries, and a dozen or so Hispanics. At Saguaro, we pretty much all looked like cousins, spoke the same language, and shared similar customs and manners. As we waited for my daughter's class to enter the arena, I did not even recognize the languages being spoken around us, nor could I place much of the native dress worn by mothers, aunts, and grandmothers. Our little nuclear family group seemed so contained, so introverted, and so Northern European, surrounded as we were by huge clans of people from Latin America and Africa. When the band struck up the entrance march and the students began filing in, huge roars went up from the crowd. This was more like World Cup soccer, although the school board specifically had banned vuvuzelas, than any high school graduation in my experience. When they called out the graduates by name, nearly everyone ignored the directive to hold their applause. Instead, families hooted and whistled, waved banners, and made a ruckus of praise for their son or daughter. I knew the exercises would be long, but I never guessed they would be so loud. At first, I felt uncomfortable. My husband, perhaps sensing this, said, "Notice, almost every group that cheers is an immigrant family. I bet their children are the first to graduate from an American school." He went on, "For some of these folks, the students might be the very first to ever go so far in school. That's the whole reason they came here. They're noisy because they're so grateful. Although we certainly could not survey every family from where we were sitting, it appeared he was right. We were not just at a graduation. We were sitting in an